Okay, so as I said, I'll have office hours if you are working on the homework. Let's say a few things about this homework. Problem number one, as I already indicated, is just a bunch of vector exercises. You take the magnitude, you take the dot product, you take the cross product, and so forth. And number two is you have 2-point charges at specified locations, and all you need to do is add vectorially the Coulomb forces, Coulomb electric fields emanating from them. And then draw some pictures, okay, three-dimensional pictures. These are just sketches for you to visualize where the fields are, how the fields are pointing out as vectors. Problem number three is a problem where you are given a lab setting in which there is an unknown magnetic field and electric field at the origin, and you are given enough data to figure out those electric and magnetic field by solving the problem. What you are given is the force, a charge, I think it's 1 coulomb charge, experiences in response to these fields under 3 different velocities. Okay, that gives you enough data for you to be able to get these 2 vector quantities, each of them having 3 scalar components. Okay? One of them, like finding the electric field is very easy because you are given the force on the charge for 0 velocity situation. That directly gives you from the Lorentz force, the electric field, since electric field is force per unit charge. And then using the remaining data, you find the magnetic field. Problem number four is just finding the electric field in one reference frame when you know the electric field and the magnetic field in another reference frame. We talked about the fact that the force would be the same in all reference frames, and that's what you exercise. Problem five is a little bit complicated, and it compensates for this by asking you really not solving a complicated situation, but discuss a complicated situation. We have time-varying magnetic and electric fields described in a certain situation. This situation is actually a cavity. In this cavity, we have a time-varying electric and magnetic field. That structure is given. And then it asks you to think about the dynamics of a charge that are located at 2 different locations. In one of those locations, the magnetic field is equal to 0, therefore it doesn't contribute. In another location, the magnetic field is not equal to 0, but the initial motion of the charged particle is carrying the charged particle with a velocity parallel to the magnetic field. So initially there is no impact there either of the magnetic field. But as time progresses, the charge now develops a velocity that is not in the direction of the magnetic field. At that point, V cross B starts kicking in and it's going to have a response, okay? We want you to just write down all these things in a descriptive mode rather than carrying out. You're not asked to solve Newton's law of electrodynamics, basically. That would be too complicated of a problem. And problem number five, problem number six, this is a flux calculation, and it is something like this. We have a cube of 1 meter cube, and its locations are specified, and then there is a certain current density, J is given, okay? J has a certain current density. I think it's pointing in this direction, and I think minus, this is the current density itself. This is in units of amperes per meter squared. So then we are asking you to calculate the flux over this cube. And what that means is that you have to visit each of the 6 faces, and each of the 6 faces, you are supposed to calculate the flux. And there, what you're really doing is this integral, J dot ds. This ds are the unit vectors that are pointing away from the volume in each direction. And at the end, it turns out that we have the location of the cube itself matters in this case. And it is sitting at the corner. The corner is touching the origin, so it's between 0 and plus 1 in x, y, and z directions. And it turns out that with this type of a current configuration, you're going to have fluxes, equal and opposite fluxes, on the side faces of the cube, and their contribution to the total flux is going to cancel out. But what doesn't cancel out is the contribution coming from the top and the bottom. Okay? And then we are asking, As a consequence of this, is charge going to accumulate, increase inside or decrease inside this foil? And the last part says, in view of what charge is accumulating, will the electric flux for the same cube going to be increasing or decreasing? So you should look at the current distribution and decide whether charge is coming net, in the net sense, is it accumulating inside the cube or not? Okay, so that's the problem. Any questions here? Yes?
Where should we turn in the homework?
Oh, the homework. How should we do it? There is a box.
Yeah.
Okay, that box should be ready by Friday. I will get it marked. The usual way that we've been doing it to tenants so far. Okay. Any questions about this? Okay, so let's continue with our notes. And today we're going to talk about divergence and curl. And we have already mentioned this several times in our initial lecture. But then we focused on Gauss's law, which was an integral formulation of electrostatics. That's the equation that we see over there. The displacement D stands for epsilon naught times the electric field. And its flux is equal to the total charge contained in the volume that is surrounded by surface S. And now we are writing here the total charge in terms of the charge density and volume integral. Okay? So that is how we write Gauss's law in integral form. In differential form, corresponding to this is simply divergence of D is equal to rho. How do we get that? Well, we get it by remembering something, a derivation that you might have seen in Math 241. The important point about Gauss's law in integral form is a constraint on the D field that you find in life, but it's a constraint that applies with all possible surfaces S surrounding all possible volumes. All right, so this should be applied over any surface that you can imagine. You can apply it over large volumes, you can apply it over small volumes. To go to the differential form, we're going to apply it to a very small volume, okay? And that application to a small volume simplifies the evaluation of certain aspects of this equality, and then you get basically a differential relationship. It's a quite straightforward exercise. And for that exercise, here is our little cube that we are going to envision. Okay, so we're going to apply it to a small volume, and being in Cartesian coordinates, working in Cartesian coordinates, we're going to get a relationship that's going to be in terms of the ddx, ddy, ddz operators, and because of this, we are selecting a cubic volume. Okay, if you go to the appendix of Rao's book, you see that divergence is being calculated. Formula for divergence is being derived there in that appendix for different coordinate systems. Cartesian coordinate system, cylindrical coordinate system, and spherical coordinate system. So an exercise is carried out with different shapes. Okay, so instead of a cube, you would consider a another shape, volume shape, that would be conforming to the spherical coordinates if you were doing the spherical coordinate derivation. And you would end up with a different formula for finding out the divergence in spherical coordinates. But that's not going to play a role in this class. It does play a role in 350. Okay? So with this, therefore, this problem, of course, is resembling the problem that I was alluding to over there. In your homework problem number 6, you calculate the flux over the surface of a cube in terms of J. Here, we are going to do it in terms of D. And that's the only difference. Now, for the right-hand side, the volume integral of the charge density, because we are making this to be so small, we can approximate it whatever the central value of the charge density is. That charge density, in general, will be varying as a function of position x, y, z. But if you make it small enough, taking the central value and simply multiplying with the dimensions of the three sides of this cube would be a good enough of an approximation. Okay. And this approximation will get better and better as you are making the delta x, delta y, delta z smaller and smaller. So at the end, when we balance both sides of the equation, take the limit, we're going to have an exact relationship. Okay, what about that's the approximation for the right-hand side. What about a corresponding approximation for the left-hand side? Well, now we have to pay attention to the six faces of this cube and do a sort of a calculation that you are sort of doing in solving problem number 6. You pay attention to fluxes at each one of those faces. But actually, the exercise here is simpler than your homework problem. There is no integration is involved. That is simply because we are selecting these phases to be so small that we are going to approximate the fluxes on each phase by simply products. Okay? You look at the first term, and the first term contributes, represents the contributions coming from two phases of this cube here. I have a phase here, number two, phase number one, and these phases have unit normal vectors that are pointing in x direction and minus x direction. Okay? So there is going to be a certain x component for the D field that matters. Why is it that the x component only matters? Because in flux calculation, what am I really calculating on each phase? The dot product of the D field on that surface with the unit vector that it's pointing out, multiplied times the area of that. Okay, so basically then, the contribution that I have to take into account at each of these phases are selecting the x component, y component, and the z component of the displacement vector in turn. So therefore, this is a quite easy exercise. For phase number two, I have x component, and also the ds is pointing in the x direction. Therefore, the sign is positive. For phase number one, there is a pair of opposite vectors that are involved. Because of that, there is a minus sign. Therefore, we have dx component on phase two minus dx component divided by, so minus the x component on phase one. I should be really showing the top one. Multiply with the area involved, and that is delta y times delta z. That accounts for the first term. Likewise, the second term is related to phases number four, which is coming with a positive sign, and phase number three, which is coming with a negative sign. And finally, the z component is associated with phases five and six, as seen. Any questions about it? This is quite straightforward. It is this quantity that I equate to the other quantity that I have from the previous phase, which is rho times delta x, delta y, delta z. And then I can divide both sides of the equation by delta x, delta y, delta z. And that leads to a simple rho on one side. But on this side, delta y, delta z is canceled out. Delta x goes into the denominator. What we are seeing there for the first term, therefore, is a finite difference expression that corresponds in the limit to a partial differentiation operator here. Any questions here? That's the straightforward sort of derivation that you must have seen. Something similar to this in your math course. So then, this is still a sort of an approximation, but when we take the limit, we have the convergence, we have partial derivative of the x, y, and z component with respect to x, y, and z is equal to rho. That is the differential form of Gauss's law. Now, this is what, of course, something where we use the del notation, and we say that if we define a vector operator with dx, dy, dz components, and then treat the dot product of this operator into a vector d with the dx and dy and dz components, and then sort of like agree that the application of each of those components added up. In other words, we are using sort of algebraic procedure to represent a calculus procedure. As long as we all agree to do that consistently, we can write the same expression in terms of the divergence, del dot d. We interpret it. The d dx, d dy are being applied to the x, y, z component and being summed up. Later on, when we use the same del operator, but instead of dot multiplication, we apply cross multiplication and still agree to use the usual rules of cross multiplication, which is using the determinant technique that we know. That is what we are going to be calling the curl rather than the divergence. The divergence is taking the d vector field and turning it into a scalar that we are seeing. Okay, whereas the other operator, the operation with cross multiplication that is giving curl, it is generating a vector field out of a vector field. Those are the two distinctions. Any questions? So that's the divergence of D is equal to rho. So we have basically now two different ways of referring to Gauss's law. The integral rule that you know, the integral form of the Gauss's law that you are very familiar with from 6 to 12, and here's the differential form which we are going to be using increasingly. And perhaps, of course, similar type of mathematical exercises you are familiar with from your math course. Any questions? So basically, if I give you a D field and ask you to calculate the corresponding divergence and ask you what is this physically significant, you say this must be the charge density over there. All right. So also, the divergence is sensitive to derivatives, the variation of the charge, the vector field in question, in the direction that the vector field itself is pointing. When we calculate the curl, we are going to see that there is a sensitivity to variations in directions orthogonal to where the vector field is pointing. So there are two different type of derivatives, therefore, of a vector function. Okay. It being a vector function makes it more complicated than scalar function. Therefore, its derivative is more complicated in some sense. Instead of having a single derivative, it has plural derivatives. One is a divergence, which ends up giving you a scalar quantity, but it is sensitive to variations in the directions in which the vector itself is pointing. And the other one that is it results itself in a vector field, and that is the curl, and that is sensitive to sideways derivatives. I think of them as head-on derivatives and sideways derivatives. The amazing nice thing is that the two of these derivatives combined together are complete in the sense that if you know the curl and divergence of a vector field, then you are able to reproduce the full vector field in any region bounded by a surface if you also know something about the vector field at the boundary. Okay, boundary conditions plus the divergence and curl are sufficient for you to regenerate the vector field in any domain. Questions? Okay, so some examples then. These are quite straightforward. If I specify a vector field here with 5x for dx, a constant value of 12 for y, and no z component, by applying the partial derivative summation, I end up having a constant, in this case, a constant value for the divergence. And it should be, of course, in coulombs per meter cubed, because it corresponds to rho, okay? And from that, you can also then deduce what the units of d is. D is measured in coulombs per meter square, so that when you apply one more derivative, it goes to meter cubed. And that makes sense, right? Yesterday, when we were looking at boundary conditions associated with surface charge, what did we find? We find that rho sub s matched d. Rho sub s matched d, and therefore we, at that point, pointed out that they must be having the same units, and rho sub s is coulombs per meter square, whereas rho is coulombs per meter cubed. And the line charge density is coulombs per meter. Okay, so here's another example. And in this example, we are paying attention to the electric field that we deduced last lecture for this diode problem. PN junction is going to be associated with two slabs, positive, negatively charged slabs. And we were able to apply the rules for single slabs, combine them, superposition, to come up with the given electric field distribution. This electric field distribution is pointing as a vector in x direction. For the infinite slab in y and z, there is no electric field in the y direction and also in the z direction. Therefore, a single component, what is the corresponding divergence? The corresponding divergence is going to be ddx applying on e sub x only, because e sub y and e sub z are equal to zero. So basically, that gives us an expression that is going to correspond to the slope here and the slope here. Now, is this slope positive or negative? Negative. And that is going to correspond to our negative charge density. And the slope here is positive, that's going to correspond to the positive slab that is giving you this overall electric field configuration. All right. So whenever electric field is changing in the direction of the component for which it is defined for, then you're going to be finding a charge density that supports it. Questions? Okay. So in summary then, we have the differential form and the integral form. Okay? So if we take the differential form and integrate on both sides over a volume, then the left-hand side of this equation would become equal to the left-hand side of this equation. But on the right-hand side, the right-hand side of this equation would be equal to the right-hand side of this equation. On the left-hand side, I would have the volume integral of divergence of D, and that has to match the surface integral of D dot ds, as indicated in this equation. And this is an equation that you saw in Math 241 as the divergence equations. Okay, this is the divergence theorem from 241. Sort of like we are discovering it in a roundabout way, but we could have used this directly to go from here to here or vice versa. Okay, if you know this little mathematical fact, you can go back and forth between the differential form and the integral form. So divergence of B is equal to zero. That means also implies through the divergence theorem that is flux integral is equal to zero, etc. Any questions? Okay, so that's that much for divergence. It is easy to take the divergence of fields. It's because it's like a derivative, as we were pointing out last lecture. Differentiation is an easy operation. And if you have the field, you find the corresponding charge density in case of electrostatics. Curl. So now let's talk about curl. This is where we apply the very same differential operator, del, like a cross product following the rules of cross multiplication. Okay? And that is implemented using the determinant method as usual, giving us three different components for the final result. So you end up with a vector. You start with a vector, you differentiate in a certain fashion, and it becomes a vector, the curl vector, and its x, y, and z components now are sensitive to these derivatives, which are sort of like acting in orthogonal directions. For instance, for the x component, we have d dy of e sub z. So we have the z component being differentiated not with respect to the same direction, but due to an orthogonal direction, minus derivative of e sub y with respect to z. So this is where that sideways derivative thing that I was talking about is applying. Okay? And this way, we have all three components produced. Going back to the divergence operator and looking at the divergence theorem, you can sort of see from here that divergence of D has to be the flux of D per unit volume. Okay? That is exactly what this equation is saying. Okay? When you take the divergence and integrate it over volume, you get the flux. So flux is divergence per unit volume. And you could have seen that from the derivation for the divergence that we started the lecture with. We calculated the flux over this cube, okay, and divided that flux by delta x, delta y, delta z, which was the volume of that enclosed surface. And then we took the limit of delta x, delta y, delta z going to zero to arrive at the proper definition of divergence. So in that sense, if you have, what is divergence? It is the flux per unit volume that is calculated in a given vector field. Okay? So in some sense, there is a similar sort of interpretation of curl. But that's a little bit more complicated. It turns out that it is related to a line integral per unit area. Whenever you do a closed line integral, you enclose a surface. Okay, that surface has a certain area. Okay, so if you take a line integral of a first quantity, a vector quantity, and divide it by the area, and take the limit of that area shrinking, and you do this three times for three different surfaces, one pointing in x direction by its normal, the other pointing in y direction by its unit normal, and the third one in z direction, you end up with three scalars. Those three scalars jointly describe a vector, and that is the curl vector. Okay, so curl vector then is associated with closed line integrals per unit area, whereas divergence is associated with volume integral per unit volume, surface integral per unit volume. Okay. So here we have one example where we take the curl of a given vector quantity, and we have a vector defined by a y-varying x component and a constant y component, and we end up with a curl that is pointing only in z direction, and it has a sine y variation. We illustrate here on the side picture both this particular vector field as well as the magnitude of its curl. Okay. This vector field sort of like has a constant y component, but its x component is varying. Okay, and because of that, we have this variation of the direction. Okay, and the x component that is varying is going to be associated with a certain derivative that is in an orthogonal direction, and that is the contributing factor in this case for our expression, which ends up being z hat times sine y. And when we take the absolute value of sine y and plot it here as shades, in this picture, bright means strong and dark means zero. Okay, so where you have regions of darkness, then that sideways derivative is weak, and where you have bright, that sideways derivative is large. If we look at the vector field, where it is brightest, we have the vector going from one side to the other side. Okay, so the y derivative, y is going through zero crossing, and zero crossing is where the change is taking place most strongly. So that all makes sense. All right, so now we have the tools. Okay, we have the tools for providing the full set of electrostatic equations. We already know that electrostatic fields satisfy Gauss's law, okay? And how did we reach that? We reached that by looking at the Coulomb's field. We said that Coulomb field of a single charge is an electrostatic field, and all electrostatic fields are nothing but superpositions of many, many Coulomb fields. And by doing that superposition, we were able to go from the Coulomb's law into Gauss's law. And we also made a statement that we haven't proven, but it turns out to be true. While the Coulomb's law is valid only for static situations, the resulting equation, Gauss's law, is also true for dynamic situations. But we also lost some information in going from Coulomb's to Gauss's law, because instead of a full specification, we have an integral specification. What is missing is the fact that all the electrostatic fields not only satisfy Coulomb's law, but they also satisfy a second condition of having curl-free electric fields. The electric field has zero curl. Okay, so then when we accompany the fact that divergence of D is equal to rho, where D is epsilon naught times E, with the equation curl of E is equal to zero, then we have the full specification. You're going to say, where do you see that the curl of electric field is equal to zero for the static situation? The answer is, wherever all we know about static fields are coming from, which is, where did we start? Coulomb's law, okay? From Coulomb's law, we were able to go to Gauss's law, okay? But from Coulomb's law, we can also show that the curl of the electric field is always equal to zero if a field is nothing other than shifted superpositions, shifted and weighted superpositions of Coulomb's law. And this is because, first of all, linearity applies, okay? If we take the curl of an electrostatic field, that means we are taking the curl of many, many superposition of many Coulomb fields, and you can exchange the order of taking the curl and doing the summations. You go to a single Coulomb field that is emanating from the origin and apply the curl operator there, and you find that it has zero curl. Okay, therefore, all static fields coming from Coulomb's law not only satisfy Gauss's law, but another property, that is the curl of the total static electric field is equal to zero. And that gives us the pair of equations that I had on the right-hand side on the top as I started lecture number one. And maybe it is somewhere here once again. In the next lecture, that's what we're going to see. Okay, and this example that you may look at is showing that the curl of the electric field that is coming out from an infinite line with lambda Coulombs per meter charge density is curl free. Okay, so you go to Coulomb's law, apply the curl condition, you're gonna get a curl free result. You're gonna go to any one of those fields that we have calculated the last two lectures, the field of a infinite line charge and an infinite surface, charge surface and all that, they're all going to give you zero curl. Okay, and this little calculation is for the case of the field of an infinite line. In the homework, you're going to be doing this calculation for the Coulomb field, which is the most essential one. Okay, so let's move on to lecture number 5. So in this lecture, we are going to now start addressing the question of how do we really solve electrostatic problems for arbitrary charge distributions from the equations that we have developed. Divergence of B is equal to rho, curl of E is equal to 0, accompanied with D is equal to epsilon naught times E, and all this in free space. So far we have not talked about material media, which is something that we're going to talk about next week. So far we are talking about only free space. And if we are talking about materials, we are talking in materials in a roundabout way. A material is nothing other than a collection of atoms, and atoms have charges in them. So in some way, the transition from the free space into Hellwig material medium is going to be obtained with a model that models the material medium as a collection of charges, positive and negative charges, and some of them are combined into atoms in which we have bound rather than free charges. But that's going to be the approach, and that approach can be started from the free space equations which we are dealing with right now. So how do we solve this problem? That's what we want to address now. Now, turns out that this general problem can be most easily and naturally solved by invoking this concept of a scalar function, a scalar potential. And that scalar potential is, in our circuit models, is really what we call the voltage. Okay, so there is a link between all the fields in three-dimensional space that we are talking about and their implementation in discrete circuits. And we are going to now see something that is related to the link between electromagnetics and the circuit theory. Okay, the static equations always satisfy these conditions. They are always curl-free. And one asks the question, how do we know? How can we generate a curl-free vector field? What guarantees that something is curl-free? And the answer is here. Something is going to be curl-free, a vector field is going to be curl-free, if it is obtained from a scalar quantity, a scalar function, B of x, y, z, by taking its gradient. Okay, so now we are now reminding you the third thing that you learn in Math 241, div, grad, curl. All three of them in the Cartesian coordinate system obtained by the application of the del operator, dx, dy, dz, in terms on scalar functions for the gradient, and for vector fields, either in the form of del dot, which gives you the divergence, or del cross, which gives you the curl operator, or the curl of a vector field. So the statement here is that take a vector, arbitrary vector function of x, y, and z, call it v of x, y, and z, and take its gradient. That is, form a vector by taking its partial differentiation with respect to x, y, and z, and make that three components of a vector field. That electric field is going to be curl-free. Because it's going to be curl-free, that is going to be associated with a static solution. And there should be some charge distribution in volume associated with it, or perhaps such a field, static field, might be coming from the boundaries of the region, in which case the sources are contained at the boundaries. So how do we know that all the statement is right? Well, let's just take the curl of the gradient of V and see what we get. All right? And what you get is zero. So that then gives you the proof or the verification of that statement. And that is by having, for the x component, we have d dy of the z derivative of v. But from that, we have to subtract the z derivative of dv dy. Those are the same things, because the order doesn't matter in the differentiation, so they cancel out. So we have for the x component, 0. Likewise, for the y component and z component, we have 0. Okay? So curl-free. Curl-free means a vector field whose curl is equal to 0. A curl-free vector field can always be derived from the gradient of a scalar field. All right? If I give you the scalar field, you take its gradient, that gives you the curl-free field, like in this equation. Alternatively, if I give you the v function, the e function, you can go into the corresponding scalar field by doing line integration, which is something that we're going to be looking at shortly. But there is a minus sign here, and that minus sign is for convention. Okay, that minus sign doesn't matter for the purposes of this proof. Okay, but that minus sign that we adopt in electrostatics is such that there is a potential function v, and there is an associated electric field function, which is a vector function. And electric field is always pointing from regions of large v towards small v. That is the convention. If we didn't have the minus sign, it would be the other way around. Okay? So that is itself then related to about the concept of voltage drops and voltage rises that can be confusing in some circuit problems initially. Any questions here? Okay, so as an example here, we start with a potential function, x squared minus 6y, and we take its gradient. That means that we're going to apply on this function ddx, ddy, ddz, as we are doing here. And we're going to follow the convention and use the minus sign as well to define the corresponding electric field. Okay, so what do we get here? X squared minus 6y with respect to dx becomes 2x, but there is a minus sign, we have minus 2x here. And with respect to ddy, we have minus 6, but that becomes plus 6 here, and z component is equal to 0. We construct it as this particular vector field. Okay? It has a constant y component, but its x component depends on x, and it is changing. Okay? And that can be plotted, just to have an idea what this field looks like, and here we go. Okay, constant y component, but then the x component is changing sign, and it's the structure that we are seeing here. And what we have here is, as the background color, the strength, the potential itself that we differentiated in order to get this vector function. And once again, bright colors indicate large values of potential, and dark values get smaller values. And what you're seeing there is the fact that the vectors, the electric field vectors, are pointing from regions of large potential towards regions of small potential. Okay, had we had not the minus sign in our definition, it would have been the other way around, but this is the basic convention. Any questions here? So why do we want to do this? Well, we want to do this because we can sort of like, if we represent our electric field in terms of a potential, that is say Re is equal to minus the gradient of a vector function, we can substitute that into this equation and forget about this equation because that has been utilized to select our electric field as the minus the gradient of B. This becomes a single equation that's known as Poisson's equation. It becomes a second order equation in terms of scalar V and scalar rho. And that solution is rather easy to obtain using numerical techniques and so forth. So for arbitrary charge distributions, you go from the Poisson's equations to the potential V. Once you find out how V is varying as a function x, y, and z, getting electric field is very easy. You just differentiate. You just pointed out that differentiation is easy, minus the gradient of whatever potential that you get is the electric field that you are looking for. But that comes in the next lecture, the Poisson's equation, I believe. Right now, we are going to now deal with the opposite question of, while it's easy to go from V to E, how do you go from E to V? Okay, and the answer to that is by doing line integrations. Okay, and line integrations between a point and another point where we assign zero potential or the ground is an important calculation. Another important calculation is the line integral that you start here, go somewhere and come back and loop around. Clothesline integrations. That clothesline integration is going to also be an important concept as we go along, related to the curl. It's that line integral per unit area is what ends up being the curl. Okay, but we should be able to evaluate these types of line integrals and get the potentials for electrostatic fields. You may ask the question, when you do a line integral like that, does it matter how you go from point A to point B? Does it matter you go this way or this way? The answer is, it doesn't matter if you're dealing with an electrostatic field. It doesn't matter if you're dealing with a field whose curl is equal to zero. For static fields with zero curls, which can be represented in terms of potentials, you have a unique line integral result independent of the path that you take. What only matters are the beginning and ending points. Okay, this is why in static situations you are able to come up with a distribution that we call the potential distribution that is unique except for the selection of one point. That is what we call ground. We can arbitrarily take a point and assign zero potential to that, but from there on the potential calculated at every other point in comparison does matter, and that vector field upon taking its gradient provides you with the electric field. Any questions? So then we want to sort of like deal with these types of line integrals going from a certain position to another position. All right, so this is depicted here. We decide to follow a certain path. We take that path and break it into little segments. At each segment, we have a vector that is remembering the direction of the starting and the direction of the position that you start with and the position that you end. So therefore, these are directed segments. Therefore, they are vectors. And at each segment, we are going to take the dot product of the electric field that is defined there with this segment. Okay, and that gives you a scalar. And then you add all these scalars up, going from the beginning point to the end point, and that sum is the line integral that we are talking about. In the limit, these segments are shrinking down to nothingness. So this definition of the line integral is therefore very reminiscent of the flux integral that we discussed a couple of lectures ago, right? We took a surface, we broke it into patches. At the center of each patch, we calculated the dot product of the unit normal to the area normal and the D field or the E field or whatever we're dealing with, and summed it up. This is a similar sort of a definition, okay? And you're going to get a certain result, and you may get a different result if the electric field that you are working with is not a static field. If you are dealing with a dynamic electric field, which follows in its full dynamic detail, not this equation, but this equation, which is Faraday's law, then you are not going to get the same numerical value for these two path integrals, starting at the same point and ending up at the same point. But if dB dt is equal to zero, we are in a static situation. We are dealing with a vector field E that can be obtained by taking the gradient minus the gradient of a scalar function, you're going to get a unique result. Okay? And therefore, you are going to be able to, starting at any ground to which you assign zero potential and doing a line integral independent of which path you follow, you are going to be able to assign to every other point other than the ground point some scalar value, and that's going to be the potential that you are looking for. Questions? Okay, so let's now, before we continue this any further, look at sort of an example where we actually calculate line integrals for two different fields. One of them is a curl-free vector field. The other one does have a curl, okay? And these are the fields that I will write here. It's over there, but let me repeat it in a larger fashion. Two vector fields. They are all going to be, both of them are going to be written in one go. And that is x hat y plus or minus y hat x, as we see over there. And these two vector fields, if we were to plot them, would show the shapes that we are seeing here. The top one is with the plus sign, x hat y plus y hat x, okay, which is of course nothing at the origin because everything is zero. But if you go to 1, 1, okay, x and y are equal to 1 each, and the vector sum is x hat plus y hat, that's pointing over in that direction. So it gets the shape that you are seeing basically over here. Okay. And this turns out to have a curve. This is curve-free. Sorry, this is the curve-free example that I have. And I'm going to do two line integrations going from this position to this position. One is going to take this path, the other is going to take this path. Okay? We're going to do it algebraically, but we are also going to look at it from a perspective of graphics. Okay? And because it's going to be curl-free, we are going to see that it is associated with same value, independent of path. And you can already sort of see that from the picture here. Okay? There is a contribution of the line integral coming along this line, and that is equal to zero, because as I am displacing myself in the direction that I can call y direction, my electric field is pointing in x direction. Because of that, all the dot products are equal to zero along that edge. Is that clear? So there's no contribution to the line integral that is taking the upper path from this edge. But in this edge, there is going to be a lot of contributions because I can see that there is a parallel component of the electric field in the direction that I am moving. And I am moving in the same direction as the vector field is contributing or pointing. Therefore, those are all positive contributions. I'm going to end up with a positive contribution. Now, we look at the other path. In the other path, this time the bottom contributes nothing because I have motion in this direction, the integration is taking place in this direction, but my vectors are pointing orthogonal to it. But then I come to this edge. The story in this edge is reminiscent of the story in this edge. In the direction that I am moving, I have the components of the fields. Again, they are contributing the same way. It looks like we're going to end up with the same result in this particular case when we do the line integral. That is the curl-free case. How do we know it is curl-free? Well, we take its curl and see what it is. Its curl is equal to zero for this particular case. The second field that I have, that has a minus sign, okay? That has a different type of a structure. It sort of has a curly structure, actually. So it's turning around, okay? You may imagine that if you were to take this field and do a closed line integration, that is not going to give you zero quantity. And if you take the curl of this function, right here, with the minus sign, and that is shown, that exercise is shown on the top, you get -1, -1, okay? And no cancellation, -2. Okay, so that is a vector field that seems to have a certain curl, and when we look at the line integration over the two paths that are now considered in a similar fashion, you see that in this case, you are going to end up with different values. All right, I can see that the upper path is going to give me a positive quantity, and what does this give? Negative. You see that it's going in the other direction. All right, so that this is sort of like a very graphical illustration of the fact that line integrals between two points does not have to have a path-independent value to it. Okay, it is an exception for the line integrals going from point A to point B to be independent of path. But that exception is relevant for electrostatics. That exception is also relevant for all the surface stuff that we've been doing in ECE 210 and ECE 110 and so forth, okay? Our Kirchhoff's law, going around, adding up all the voltages around the loop and making it equal to zero after we take into account the positives and negatives, drops and rises, or saying it in another fashion, going around any loop in a circuit, the sum of all the rises is equal to the sum of all the drops. Okay, all has to do with the curl-free situation. It is only in that small class of vector potential, vector fields, that this is the free case. But it's a very important special case. Okay. Any questions here? Okay, so then how do we do this sort of through calculus rather than graphically? Well, we do it carefully. The answer is we do it carefully, and we have to pay attention to the signs, we have to pay attention to the upper limits and lower limits of integration and so forth. But I'm going to go E dot dl, going from the first point to the last point, okay? And E dot dl, by definition, is ex dx, ey dy, ez dz, okay? And in this case, I know what my ex is, I know what ey is, and my ez is equal to zero. I substitute the known exs and eys, and there is a plus and minus distinction because I'm doing both problems. I'm doing these two problems in parallel in this example. One with a curl-free vector field, and the other is the curly one. The one with the plus sign is the curl-free one, that was the top picture. The one with the minus sign is the curly one. And evidently, I have to do this integral, y dx plus or minus x dy. And of course, when I do that, I have to do it for the two paths. And doing it for the two paths is two different exercises that I have to go through. So first, I do for one of the paths. This goes from the, it goes through the top. C sub u is the top path. And then I do it for the bottom path. First, we go this way. That's the blue path that we have. All right? So let's see whether I have done this correctly for the upper path. For the upper path, first, I take steps in my direction. Therefore, in the upward segment of the first path, I have to take dy as my active variable, but dx is equal to 0. Okay? So that is coming from one of these terms that we have here. That is the dy. The second component is what I first latch on, that is the significant part in the first part of the path, and that comes with a plus or minus x multiplying dy, and this is being carried out at x equal to 0, right? Because the first path, the upward section, is coming at x equal to 0, but at x equal to 0, because I have x here, this whole thing goes out to 0, I have no contribution here. And that is, of course, consistent with the picture that we have here. We advertise that, we show that graphically, you can see that there is no contribution coming from the upward path along the y-axis. Okay, what about the rest? The rest comes from the second portion of the path, and that is going to be active with dx, dy is equal to 0, and that is coming from y dx contribution. But y dx contribution is coming not at any value of x, but it is coming at y equals 1, sorry, not at any value of y, but y equals 1, because you have already risen up, okay? So that is that portion of the integration. So this y becomes 1, therefore it's the integral of 1 times dx, so that becomes x, evaluated between 1 and 0 gives us 1. So here is the result. So in this path, we ended up with unity value, evidently for both of our vector fields. For both of our vector fields, we ended up with the same scalar value, 1, okay? And that is evident also from the picture, right? For both vector fields, going through the upper path, we end up with a positive quantity, and we figured out that positive quantity is 1. Okay, the second line is interpreted the same way, but this time we pick up a plus and minus 1 distinction, because this time, the term that is coming here with plus and minus 1 is the non-zero one, and that carries over its distinction here. We have two different values, okay? Which is meaning that in one of them, corresponding to the curl-free field, we ended up with the same value. For the curly field, we ended up with different values. That finishes more or less this particular exercise. And after this exercise, for a while, we stick with curl-free fields, okay? Because we're sticking with curl-free fields, we don't care which path we integrate. That's it. Okay, thank you.